your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming at you live from Austin, Texas. Hot diggity. Please do not forget that the Dudes and Beer podcast is now officially brought to you live by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, want to start up a podcast for yourself, friends, family, fun, church, school, business, whatever, stop on by PodcastCadet.com. That is the website that you want to go to. One-on-one private consultation is what we provide over there. And once you're there and once you're in the system, we hook you up with professionals, be they audio engineers to teach you how to hook everything up, people to teach you how to edit, people to teach you everything from social media to distribution, monetization, branding, all of it. Even if you have a show that you just want to hit the next level, they do audits, all that kind of stuff, so they can take your show as it exists, evaluate it, and tell you where you can improve, where you can hit that next hump. Stop on by the website today. PodcastCadet.com is the website. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use for 20% off your entire cart. Sorry, folks. I've got a little bit of a camera issue here that I am trying to figure out. And let's see if I can get it. Oh, is it going to work? Hey, there it is. All right. Yeah. Welcome back to the show, everybody. I am so entirely excited to have our guest on this evening. Tonight, we have Mike Merrill on the East Coast and Mike Wilson on the West Coast talking to us this evening about, just life in general. And why do people act that way? And what can I do about it? Is the incredible book. They are a duo of guys that go out and talk to people about things like this and kind of try to help people get back to a point of understanding, which I think that we are really in need of highly in our country at this point right now. We have actively come up against the fact that families do not talk. Families are no longer together for the holidays, be it Thanksgiving, be it anything like that. Since all of this has started, we have literally seen the almost dissolution of the American family as we know it in this country. So we will be talking about things like that, how we can get back to a point of conversation, dialogue with each other. Let's get into that right after this amazing report. We have not had a report from John Bowne in a little while. He took some time off for his family. So he is back in action out there doing some great things. Here is a report that he did on all of the post madness that is going on right now. We know John Bowne. He's a great guy. He's got his opinionated pieces. This is definitely one of them, you know, but I think what's really important here is to see the actions that are happening between people in our society right now and what's actively going on. So let's check out that report from John Bowne right now.
As expected, the Trump support was massive and peaceful. Americans came out in droves to express their silenced voice against the mainstream media propaganda machine and its overlords.
We all go!
Fox News sucks!
The crowd was as diverse as they come.
The caravan of anti-Chinese Communist Party protesters making their way through D.C. Look at this, folks.
Patriotic!
What are you saying?
Asian American for Trump!
President Trump made his presence known to an appreciative crowd of patriots.
always been slow to the fight. As Americans, we don't want to fight. We are the true liberals, lowercase l, live and let live. We've got other things to do with our lives than fight. We got family, we got schools, we got businesses. We were slow to World War I. We were slow to World War II. We were slow to the Cold War. And we were slow to the culture war. But we won World War I. We won World War II. We won the Cold War. And we will win the culture war.
As did Alex Jones.
I think Alex Jones walked by.
And of course, Alex is one of the most divisive voices in the country since his banning on social media, since his banning and deplatforming in numerous places. That was a huge, huge schism and split within our country that began a big divide. And really, I think, began showing the divide between things. Once you start kind of getting to that point that you only see a them and us mentality, you don't see people as people anymore. You start seeing them as them. That's when we start getting into the problems. And this right here is the footage that we were talking about where people just start hitting each other. People literally start stalking each other down to tackle each other, all kinds of fun stuff. This is what our society has become, or not necessarily become, but the ugly side of our society that has popped up over the last many, many years. So once again, everybody, please welcome to the show Dr. Mike Merrill and Mike Wilson. How are you gentlemen doing this evening?
Just great.
Fantastic. Hopefully better than some of those, you know, people that are out there on both sides of the aisle just trying to throttle each other for no good reason, you know. And that's kind of what I want to get into with you guys this evening is this great book, Why Do People Act That Way and What Can I Do About It? And what you guys do going around the country talking together with people about these issues. So let's get into it a little bit. Dr. Mike, let's start with you. What are you a doctor of? What are you all about? How did you come to meet Mike Wilson? And then we'll talk about both of you guys.
And how long is this show?
About an hour. I understand it's been a tick or two there, Mr. Wilson.
Good evening, Chris. It's good to be with you. I am a doctor of ministry, which is a professional degree for pastors. I did not hasten to enter into doctoral studies. I was in ministry for about 28 years before I started my doctoral program. And what that allowed me to do was actually ask better questions than I was asking when I was 25.
Sure.
It allowed me to take a great wealth of experience that I had with unfinished ends and be able to start putting pieces together in such a way that I not only understood it better myself, but I could actually teach others better, more effectively with the ideas and the skills. Some of what we do is talk about issues. We have concepts, but the other side of it is really the skills, how to actually do what we're talking about in real life, in real time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not the kind of pastor that sits in an office and waits for folks to drop by so I can hold their hand and pray with them and send them out the door. I've been very engaged in many fields. I use the opportunities that I have locally to also have regional influence, statewide, region of the country, and then international. I'm always looking for something that I can do to change the world and make things a better place. Mike and I met actually because we were our respective youth leaders in our regions for a denomination 35 years ago. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that denomination invited both of us at the same time to go to headquarters for a week of meetings. And
which they still wish they had.
Yes, I'm sure They rue the day. We ended up checking into the denominational hotel at virtually the same moment. And several events occurred that one of us, we still don't remember to this day which one of us said it, but we looked at the other and said, we're going to be best friends for life. And we have been best friends for life from that time.
And on the opposite end, Mike Wilson, how did you come to the point of the confluence in life with East Coast Mike over there?
Well, like Mike said, we shared a common, actually professional work setting. We were both doing student ministries at the time. I was in ministry for almost 25 years, and then I went into education for almost 20 years. And I'm a sociologist by nature and by profession. And so we ended up in settings where we were working together on various projects. I think what's really interesting, I'm listening to those clips that you started with. I'm just going to jump in there for just a second.
Hey, go.
Because it's fascinating. The thought just came to me as you're asking that question, how in the world did you two ever find each other, and how'd you ever end up in relationship together? And I'm sitting here listening to this stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, Mike and I probably are the two most unlikely people on the planet to actually become friends. And because
we're so similar.
Yeah, in very different ways.
We're basically twins.
I've got your pictures up right now. You can see that.
Yeah. Yeah, we're twins from different mothers, but we were both born in Washington. I was born in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
He was born in the state of Washington.
Right.
So, but other than that, we're identical twins.
Other than that.
Exactly. It's just fascinating to me because I listen to the rhetoric out there, and Mike and I just did we have a podcast called Gripping Reality, and we just did one yesterday. And we did one on the whole concept of it wasn't a Pollyanna Thanksgiving kind of be thankful, grateful thing. It was a discussion we were having that we talked about, well, what is this thing called understanding other orientation and being grateful and what's going on in your life? And I think the thing that we spend a significant amount of time on that, you know, people can listen to it if they want, is that we talked about perspective a lot, and that has a lot to do with what we talk about in the book. But
yeah,
you know, when you are looking at and you refuse to look at life through any other glasses than what you have put on, you're going to end up in a very tribal situation of which drives our country right now.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so if you don't put on somebody else's glasses for a change, if you don't give yourself the opportunity to think outside your little sphere of the world and think, well, maybe, just maybe, there is a different way to look at this. I'll give you an example. One of the things here in the state of Washington, which is happening is significantly with the COVID stuff, we just had another lockdown and so on and so on. And particularly the churches are all upset because, you know, they're taking away my religious freedoms and my rights and telling us what to do. And I'm sitting here thinking, and I read some really great stuff by folks that said, you know what? No, maybe what we need to do is step back and take a different look, and maybe for the sake of understanding, we, instead of seeing this through the lenses of rights, maybe we should take it through the lenses of what's best for everyone within our culture and our society and our communities, so that people can be safe. And instead of thinking they're the bad guy and they're doing it through the perspective and vision of my glasses, they're taking my rights.
Yeah.
The big government's coming in. Instead of looking at it from a standpoint that says, maybe, just maybe, the motivation here is not about taking rights, but the motivation is about care for people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And understand that there is a different way you could look at that, because then if you start looking at it from their perspective, guess what? You could actually enter into some dialogue.
That's
now,
it.
That's a concept.
Well, and that's just it. And one of the things that I have brought up on this show more than once, I myself was a theology student with philosophy and then later went into psychology and education. And one of the things I point out regularly on this show since all this started is the Oxford definition of sociopath. A person with a personality disorder manifesting itself in extreme antisocial attitudes and a behavior and lack of conscience. And that is pretty much from both sides of the board what's happening. You know, people that are literally, like you're saying, unwilling to empathize with somebody else, unwilling to take that 2-3 steps in somebody else's shoes. So I love the fact that you are already going down that road, because that's, I mean, that's the conversation that we have on here so frequently. And it's great to hear that other people are out there having that conversation, because it is an uncomfortable conversation. It's not a fun one to have, you know? I mean, it's kind of like whenever you have to have that family meeting, you know, with your uncle, where it's like, hey, man, like, you okay? And
yeah, but I think when we approach those conversations, and we are approaching them not with trying to understand, but we're approaching them with, you know, I'm going to make my point here, and I'm going to convince you. I'm going to bring you over to my side. The problem with, and what we talk about in what we do in our training, is to help people understand, how do you do that? How do you actually have a real conversation and being able to work through with individuals instead of always trying to convince them, but really start that whole conversation from a perspective that is, I want to understand. I just want to understand, you know, how this came about. Where are you coming from? What drives this? What's going on?
Yes.
Because once I get there, then I can actually start having a real conversation.
That's right.
But until I'm willing to do that, and I'm willing to set myself aside and all of my, you know, pieces of what I want to prove. I mean, most people don't, their listening skills are pretty nil. And that's really a huge part of what we talk about in being able to understand reality. You have to come to this place of being willing to figure out what really is going on around you. So we ask those two questions. We ask the question is, what's it doing to me? What can I do about it? So when we look at that in life, those are the questions we constantly ask. And Mike's going to jump in right here. I can feel it.
I was just about to say the same thing. Go ahead.
Wait a minute. Someone has to speak for the marginalized individual who is being cast out of this conversation. What about the sociopath who stopped listening 12 minutes ago when his brand was dissed on this show, and no one cares about the sociopath who is now branded as having no empathy and being antisocial?
That's right. And you know what's funny,
challenge.
Though?
Here's the challenge.
Go ahead.
When you said at the top of the show, people get into these arguments for no good reason.
Yes.
My brain immediately fired up and said, in your opinion, there's no good reason.
That's
true. One of the challenges that we are faced with as counselors, I've been a pastor in the middle of family embroilment, community issues, political stuff, international conflicts. I've traveled all over the world. And usually I don't stay in the nice hotels. I go where real people live and hurt. And they're on different sides and they're arguing and they're screaming at each other. Both sides will call their opponent sociopath because they don't seem to communicate, develop a vibe with someone who is different than their own position. The challenge we have right now is that the world is closing in to our own micro circle. When you were showing the video of the individual who was standing up and ranting and raving and carrying on, and there are people that will look at that guy and say he's a sociopath. He doesn't care about anybody at all. He's out there screaming, spitting, and has lost his mind.
Yep.
But there are other people that will say, finally, somebody feels the way I feel.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the challenge is not who in our society is a sociopath. The sociopath is actually the loner who has no relationships, no alignment. They have no conscience. And therefore, any kind of action that triggers a response, builds some kind of animosity just to get people going, that they like. But the challenge is we tend to brand somebody whose view is different than our idea, our position, our perspective as an enemy combatant. That's where the problem originates.
Yeah, exactly. And it is putting that label on it. And that's why I read the definition sociopath and say that it's coming from both sides. Like, both of you realize that by pointing that finger and saying that, you yourself are being sociopathic. Like, it's the irony of ironies. It's horrible.
The vast majority of American society is not sociopathic.
No, they are not.
Really is
absolutely
extremely
not.
Rare.
Yeah.
And very, very dangerous.
Yes.
The reality is we've come to the point now where the very broad brush can be dipped into the pail of sociopath and slopped on anybody who disagrees with our opinion. And the conversation grinds to a halt when that happens.
I don't have a ding bell for correct answer, and I need one. Like, that's when I need, like, a rave horn, like, meh, 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 meh. Like, thank you. Like, I've got video. I should have, like, a confetti drop for moments like that. Good God, man, from both sides of the fence, people, you've got to learn to understand things from somebody else's point of view.
Did you just say you've got to do that?
Well, I know that's a strong word. You don't need to. You shouldn't have to. In theory, there should be an inner desire. Nope, there's another should. See, we could go on with that forever.
Chris, the curse words need, should, ought, or must.
Yes.
Those words have been eradicated from our vocabulary.
Good.
Mike uses them all the time.
Well, and let's get into that for a moment, because... not about you, Mike, but about the need and want.
He just put his hand up to me, and I'm like 1,800 miles away from him.
Now, because that I think is a very important part of all this, and the fact that y'all break it down to that.
Thank you. He's an authority, Mike Wilson. He knows what he's talking about, and he said, I'm right.
Let's get into these concepts real quick, because I think it's a very, very important thing. A lot of people, it's something that I tried to explain to students whenever I taught, was there is a need between want and need. There's a difference. You need very few things to live and exist. You want things because it makes your life easier and more comfortable.
Well, Chris, I'm gonna have to go here in just like 30 seconds, and I want to
before
I go,
please.
Which I'm sorry, you know, we ran into.
That's okay, my friend.
And some timing stuff.
Oh, believe me, you will be coming back on regularly.
But one of the things that, and Mike's going to run you through the PEMB model of what's going to, you know, how this works, give you a 35,000 foot look at it. But one of the things that we stress and we push, quite frankly, with all the time, is if you want to be able to understand your reality. In other words, so you're in this tribal mindset and you're angry all the time and you don't understand why that is and all those kinds of things, which, you know, we could talk about all kinds of tools and reasons for fitting that. But what we really stress is the first thing that has to, if you will, really needs to take, and I use the word need in a very real way here, is ownership.
Yes.
Of where your life is, that you, the accountability factor, there are so few victims in this world. There are victims, and I will be the first to say there are victims.
Absolutely.
But there are not, we are not victimized as much as we refuse to own our own lives, our own actions, our own decisions. And until you come to that point of beginning to have ownership and being accountable for who you are, you're going to have a very, very difficult time moving beyond tribalism and figuring that out.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that before I went, because that's kind of the center of what we talk about. And I really appreciate the time. So I'll let Mike take it from here, because I know you have no trouble talking you under the bus for a long time. So thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely, Mike. Mr. Wilson, please understand, I want you back regularly, because these are the kind of things that we talk about on this show regularly. The fact that our fight or flight mechanism is a beautiful thing that did us well for millennia, and we are literally letting that be hijacked.
Yeah.
Into that tribal mentality that turns us versus them instead of all of us for each other.
We talk about that in the PMB under motivations and how that comes to be. And
yeah.
It's really pretty easy to figure that out. All right, I got to run. So
okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
And Mike, going further with that, like that is something like you've seen my excitement on camera here. I am someone that has been trying to explain this to people for a long time. Yes. And you try, and it's real hard sometimes to do it with a gentle hand, you know, because it really is, it's a lead the horse to water situation. And kind of that tough love of, okay, now you need to figure out why you weren't able to find this water.
You can lead a horse. Wait. You can lead a horse to water and make him drink.
Sure.
That's easy.
Sure.
Just have your hand with a palm full of salt.
Okay.
The horse loves salt.
Well,
and as soon as he licks all the salt off your hand,
he'll want water. That's true. And, well, let's start kind of cracking the nut of what Mr. Wilson was talking about as he said goodbye to us, just the whole concept of ownership, because I think that's such a key part that people have forgotten about for so long, is that, and even in American society, because sure, we have that concept of, you know, I've got my rights and I'm entitled to those. Well, you're entitled to your rights until your rights start stepping on my rights. And I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten that. Like you were saying earlier before the show, with social media, there's an anonymity that comes there. You don't have that person-to-person connection the way that you used to. And I think that we discuss this regularly on the show, where that almost allows a permissiveness to this behavior, and we really have to reclaim ourselves and our minds and our mentality from this behavior. So let's crack that nut of ownership real quick when it comes to these situations and when it comes to thinking this way and really diffusing that fight or flight panic mentality that tends to take over and cause the tribalism.
The podcast title that Mike and I chose for our conversations together, that people can listen into and actually create a dialogue with us, is gripping reality. Gripping reality is, we explained it in podcast 4, is really the ownership of my sense of reality, what's happening to me. The difficulty we run into frequently in conflict or entanglement or challenging situations where people don't know what to do to achieve resolution or to somehow work through very complicated factors in their business, in their families, in their community, with neighbors, in their faith community. They run into challenges they don't know how to unravel. They can't solve a dilemma. When everything's fine, there's no issue. Mike and I don't get called into a business that's running well, and or a family situation or a church situation or a synagogue situation that is benign. But there's no reason to call in for help or assistance anyway. It's when tragedy is occurring, people are at their wits' end and they don't know what to do. Invariably, the issue of rights is societal. It's interpersonal. Yes. We go before that, before the conversation about rights. There are two critical questions that we ask. We ask them over and over. We're never going to get beyond these two questions because they're so vital. What is the factor? What is it doing to you? Can you describe what this tragedy, this death, this illness, this isolation, this financial problem, this theological question, this argument in your community, can you describe what it's doing to you personally? What is at stake for you? And secondly, what are you going to do with it, with the anger that you have, with the exhaustion that you feel, with the fear that you have, with the enamored dedication, the devotion you're feeling, or the split, the waning of that? What are you going to do with that? And when we get to those two questions, we find that many people in conflict, especially irreconcilable conflict or situations that can't be resolved, they do not have language in their own minds to describe what it's doing to them. They'll just say, I'm angry. Okay, that's an emotion. What is that doing to you? What is your anger doing to you? Well, it just makes me angry. I'm just really, yeah. I've had it. I'm getting fed up. Okay, but what is it doing to you? I don't understand the question. That's what it's doing. It's making me angry. No, you're responding with anger. What is the anger doing to you? Is it keeping you awake at night? Is it eating your resources? Yeah. Is it making you a more violent person? Are you feeling like there's no point, let's just give up? What is it doing to you? And as we begin to give some language to that question, we find people move away from the demand of their rights, of their own idea, of their sense of isolation or camaraderie only with like-minded people. They move away from that towards getting a grip on what it actually does mean to them. Then we can move to the next question. So what do you do with that anger? Yeah. When you have sleepless nights, when you're enraged at your own children, you kick the cat, or you're driving like a maniac, what are you doing with those things? And why are you doing those things? Now we find the de-escalation of very intense emotional state. Yep. From very high rage or very high depletion or very high fear. It comes down when people have language to describe what's actually happening. It's almost a delight to be able to talk to somebody that the light bulb goes on and says, I get it. I see what you're saying. I did not know how to say what was happening to me. That kind of experience is what creates meaningful dialogue.
And, you know, I'm a 45-year-old man. I am somebody who believes that more people need talk therapy than what people believe. And that's okay. I myself, and as you were telling all this, I just see myself mirrored in it because I'm an anxiety sufferer. And when I got diagnosed for my anxiety, it was because I passed out publicly. I was at the grocery store, like looking at cans of tomatoes and passed out in the aisle. Went to the doctor, found out it wasn't anything major, got on some meds and got into a little talk therapy with a nice guy named Joe. I'll never forget Joe explaining to me that the way I see the world is like a train and that I need to realize that there's a train there and it's okay. Sometimes there's a train there. There's nothing you can do, Chris. There's a train there. Like, you could try to go through the train. That's probably not going to go well for you. You should probably sit back and let the train pass by. And what that was kind of an exercise in a realization of being in the moment again in my life, and being there and being present. And it really, when I married that with the concept that the whole reason I was anxious about something was because it was something that I cared so much about that whatever just happened rocked what I cared about that much. And that's why I'm anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lashing out because I'm scared. I'm a scared animal right now. I'm backed into a corner about something that I love and care about. And it takes a little while for me to get myself out. Sure, I take meds for my anxiety, all that kind of stuff. But it literally got to a point, doctor, where I was having anxiety attacks in my sleep, man. Like, not even joking. And that's crazy. Like, I'm asleep. I should be the most relaxed in the world. But apparently I am processing some stuff so hardcore in my brain that I did not take the time to feel my way through during the day and recognize and go, okay, why did that happen? Let's start backtracing it. Let's get back to the moment that something rocked you so hard about what you cared about. And let's realize the fact that there's a train there and we just need to let the train pass by. And then I can let it go. And it doesn't bother me anymore. You know,
not as much.
And it doesn't bother you as much. Well, it bothers me that it bothers me, and it bothers me the fact that my fear is irrational. And though I can rationalize my fear and where it came from and the reason it's happening, I can't stop it in the moment.
But the fact that your fear is irrational is fine, because fear is irrational.
That's right. That's right. Like, that's psychologically, from all of my abnormal psych classes and things like that, absolutely. Like, that is the natural way to feel. Of course your fear is irrational. Like, it's an irrational thing. I'm a 6.5 foot tall dude. Why do I break a sweat when I hit a 10 foot tall ladder? That is not even falling from a height greater than my own. Like, my feet, like, you know,
you have a copy of our book up on your screen. And
yes,
there are four human heads that are all facing basically in the same direction, going in a clockwise fashion, a yellow head, a red head, mm-hmm. a blue head, and a green head. And they're set up as a Venn diagram with an overlap of each head to the next one and the one opposite it and the one that's the third away. We created that image because that single picture teaches, in essence, everything that we have to offer about how to deal with reality. The yellow head represents perceptions, and our belief is that there are 10 senses of perception, the way we take in information from the world around us and begin the processing of that information. The red head is our emotions. And over a span of about 25 years, listening to many, many people of all ages, multiple languages, multiple situations around the world, I finally began to develop a theory that there are only 5 emotional systems, just 5. And all the many, many words we use are either mild versions of one of those 5, moderate emotions, or very intense emotions of one of those 5. The blue head is motivations. And Mike and I have worked very hard on putting language to how we understand motivational theory. We came up with the idea that there are 5 drivers that affect the way we feel our emotions and prepare for behavior. Then the green one is the behavior, and we divided that only into two major aspects, either to engage a behavior or to disengage a behavior, which is just as much of a decision as engaging or acting. So when a person chooses not to act, it is as clear a decision as the decision to act. Then that actually affects our perceptions, which affects our motivations, which affects our emotions, which affects our behaviors, and it becomes totally interactive. In that picture, there's what we call the cinnamon diamond, the little brown diamond. It's not perfectly shaped. It's not exactly the right size. It doesn't overlay in precise mathematical characteristics all four heads. It's kind of off a little bit because that's the way our perception of reality really does work. No one is exactly right on. And
absolutely,
there's a question mark in that cinnamon diamond. That question mark is where we actually live with our perceptions, interacting with our emotions, interacting with our behaviors, interacting with our with our motivations, interacting with our behaviors. And yeah. And that mix is constantly changing. So you brought up the idea of anxiety, and anxiety at a very extreme level for your perception. That's in your view, that level of anxiety was more than your body could actually handle. Others may have greater capacity
absolutely
to deal with anxiety, and others may have less. We put anxiety in the emotional system that I call exposure. And exposure is how to deal with what is not safe or what is not secure.
Yeah.
Whenever you have a perception that you are in an unsafe situation or an insecure situation, be it momentary or grandiose, huge, your mind, your body, your behavior, your motivations, all your other emotions are going to trigger in on that lack of safety.
That's
now,
right.
You mentioned fight or flight. There's
strong
a third option.
Freeze.
And that's fright.
Yeah.
Which is the deer in the headlights.
That's right.
They don't run.
They freeze.
They don't put their antlers down and fight. They just stop.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so there's only three options: to freeze, to fight, or to run. And the problem is sometimes you're trying to do all three at the same time.
That's right.
It is really hard to fight and to run at the same time, which leads to breakdown.
Yeah.
So what we do is we teach the factor that is driving you to that anxiety. What is it doing to you? You can say, well, it's making me anxious. Okay, let's go beyond that.
Exactly.
Now, what do you do with the anxiety? You can say, well, I run, or I fight, or I freeze.
No, I'm a serial entrepreneur.
I build safety systems into my life for the things that I love the most. And now we can get somewhere with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I can tell you right now, Dudes and Beer was a safety mechanism. It came out of my need to do something with people outside of work, to do something with people other than AV engineers, to be social with other people. So it became a safe place for me. It became a safe haven for this kind of stuff, for this kind of hard conversation, because people are all too unwilling to have this conversation, even within their own marriages, even within their own relationships, like mother and son, father and son, you know? And it's really interesting to me how it affects every dynamic. Like, it really is the fissure point in the gym that is every single person, you know, and it decides whether you can have more facets and more shine on that diamond, or whether it's going to be something that cracks under the stress of shaping and polishing.
Yes, very well said. The PEMB system is really those four heads. P is perceptions, E is emotions, M is motivations, and B is behavior. And when we teach PEMB, with that concept, PEMB applies to business. We've dealt with small business owners who are ready to throw in the towel because they can't stand customers anymore.
Yeah.
They can't stand their vendors. They don't like their staff. They don't like who they have themselves become. Ultimately, that's what we really find. It's not the customer. It's not the staff. Yeah. It's not the vendors. It's they don't like who they have become.
Yeah.
And so when we get to that level of what is the last customer that yelled at you or wanted a refund or stormed out or made a scene in your business, what did that do to you? We find they often divert from that question back to the customer that was so annoying. So, no. I understand the customer was annoying. It was probably Satan dressed up in a woman's outfit that came walking to your store just to destroy your life.
So what he okay, does for I got, kicks.
Sure, I'm good with that.
Job's
my question
gone.
Is, what is that doing to you? And and when we can finally get a grip on that level of reality, we can begin going somewhere with that. So there's not really a reason to trash the business or destroy your partner or those kinds of things, although they happen frequently, is not necessarily what has to happen in that situation.
Well, and, you know, I've known so many people like this in my life, Doctor. So many that are amazing individuals, creative individuals, and like loving, caring, giving individuals that literally just call in the napalm strike on the bridge that they are standing on.
Right.
Regularly.
Sure. And why?
Yeah.
Why would that happen?
And, you know, I guess kind of along the same lines of what you were just talking about with those business owners, where there is something about themselves that they are so unhappy with.
Now, one of the things that I've been very fascinated by as I have walked my journey and walked alongside pastors, youth workers, individuals running their own business, politicians, people who are in various careers, a very, very fascinating aspect.
Yeah.
And that is the level of success that people are very close to attaining is terrifying to them.
Yes.
And what they will do is destroy their own success as a means by which they're off the hook. In American culture, for the most part, if you fail, fail at a business opportunity, you lost $100,000, your business closed, your best friends, your family, they'll hug you, they'll give you kisses, they'll do a fundraiser for you.
Sure.
They'll tell you, you know, you are so heroic. That is great, but you don't have to get up for work tomorrow because you're off the hook. But if you're good at what you do and you're successful, you're on the hook tomorrow for more, for a better performance, for more quick service, for a better deal, for more car sales, for whatever happens to be. And I have seen people actually destroy their own lives because they can't stand the success.
Yes.
And that sounds like that is so counterintuitive. People are like, who does not want to succeed?
It is.
And every once in a while, we'll bring a pastor or a small business owner or a family member to actually raise their hand and say, I do not want to succeed at that level. I wish I could go back to one store.
Yeah.
I wish I could just go back to where my church was 150 people and not 4,000 where I have to put on a performance to beat all performances next week because people are going to be upset if they don't get a better show this week than they got last week.
Yeah,
and I can't stand who I'm becoming.
Yes.
Because I'm too successful.
Yeah.
That we have encountered that and helped people walk even through that.
And how does that go? Because I mean, I'm one of those people that I will tell you right now, like I told you earlier with Father Andy Colzo, I don't know if you're still alive, but if you are, you were my angel for so many years. He was my confessor, he was my spiritual director. An old Cistercian monk, and he would just laugh and go, you know, how's that working out for you, Chris? you know, because I'd come in and I'd tell him the same thing. And he'd be like, didn't we talk about that last month? Just checking. Like, if we need to talk about it again, that's cool. You know, you might need a refresher, but it's still there. Just letting you know. And he was so straight about it. And it took me years to see.
One of the challenges is if something took 10 years or 20 years of your life to develop, having a conversation last month is a great starter, but we're going to have the same conversation again.
And
have it next month. We're going to have it in a few more months, and we're going to talk about it for maybe 5 years because it's going to take that long for you to recover from the damage that was done over a 10-year period. That doesn't bother me a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and that's just it. Like it became the point of realizing that I was the one sabotaging myself from success. That frequently it was the fact of success was put right on my doorstep. I just did not want it.
Yep.
Or
not at that level.
Yeah. It's or I wasn't prepared for the success when it came my way.
Level that it was happening. In our society, to be able to say, you know, I don't want success at that level. People say that makes no sense to me at all. Don't you want the biggest paycheck? If you had a paycheck of $100,000 a month, wouldn't you take a paycheck of $500,000? Can you imagine the taxes? Then you have to all of a sudden have a CPA and you have to have on and on and on and on. And you have always be wondering who's stealing from me. Where are my nickels and dimes going? Where are my thousands going?
Yep.
And you have to be spending your entire life defending your wealth. One of the things that I find fascinating is American history, world history, of how human beings have engaged success, and that has been overwhelming. Gillette, who invented a kind of stainless steel that could be ground into extremely fine razor blades, made so much money he could never have spent it in the next five generations of his family's lifetime.
Yep.
But he wasted every dime fighting other people who were trying to break his patent on how that stainless steel was made. And what ultimately happened is he achieved a level of success that destroyed him. He was so successful, he destroyed himself. That's just an absolutely fascinating story. The guy who invented the bottle cap, this is called Beer, Dudes and Beer.
Yep.
The cap.
I love this story. Cap, please tell it.
The guy who invented that cap made so much money. He was so successful. And he had 17 crimps, and somebody came up with a machine that would make 19 crimps, and he spent all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States fighting that guy over making a crimper that would make about to replace the cork. Yep. Instead of saying I'm successful beyond my imagination, he could not tolerate that. That just absolutely fascinating. I love that stuff.
Well,
it means, hey, us normal schmucks that just live down here in the kind of just outside the gutter. It's okay.
Well, and the thing is, like, I've always been one of those people, even whenever I take on clients, things like that, like, you determine your own level of success. Please do not, and I cannot wait as my son gets older to instill that in him and have him understand the fact that your success is different from other people's success, son. Just because you're not good at history doesn't mean that you don't enjoy math.
Sure.
You know?
Absolutely. Or art or music.
Well, you can see the setup behind me. This is how I make my living now. And for years, people told me, like, and literally the case was, well, whenever you're done playing with all those wires, you know, you may want to get a job.
Right. Do something real with your life.
Dude, I'm a skilled laborer now, Jack.
One of my Facebook friends, a young woman that I know, said that she used to get on her report card, talks too much. And she said, I think every girl in sixth grade probably got on their report card, talks too much.
Mine said distraction to himself and others.
Right. But numerous people were posting on her thread there about how they got that too, you know, talks too much.
And
I wrote in and I said, I think every sixth grade boy got the phrase, does not live up to potential.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's kind of, you know, just to be real and like emotionally real for a moment. I had to break it to my mom. I love my mom very much. Mom, if you're listening tonight, I know you do occasionally. I love you very much. But when COVID started happening and the schools started locking down and the kids didn't get to go to graduation, she was like, "Oh, all these poor kids." I'm like, "Mom, I think you're, oh, I think you're thinking, oh, poor parents." I was like, I, as a high school senior, I do not remember it being like, "Man, I can't wait to walk across the stage Saturday. That's going to be great." Like, you know, like that school was over. Awesome. Like, I've got college coming up. I got job. I still got work. You know, right. it was one of those, like, that was a day that was for my mom. And when I almost didn't graduate because of economics, it was a day that I almost destroyed my mother emotionally. Sure. 'Cause she was like, "My God, I've told all these people to come for a graduation and you may not be graduating." You know, so it's really one of those, like you were saying.
And here's the challenge. I don't know that your mother actually said this, but parents do say this kind of thing. So how is it going to make me look if you don't graduate?
I don't know.
That's really what, but that's really at the core of this conversation.
It is.
Is your behavior becomes my penalty. And so when we get into a conversation, why is that doing that to you? Where is that coming from?
Yes.
What is it that is, why is your identity tied to what your child is experiencing as a result of hard work or not hard work? They get a B plus. Why does that reflect on you?
Yeah.
And to be able to then unpack that. I'm not saying that that's absolutely wrong. I'm saying, what does it do to you? And a parent that says, "Hey, I want to feel proud of what my kid did." So, okay, how does that work out for you?
I mean,
that's a legitimate question. It's not a setup question to show you how wrong you are. When somebody says, "I'm good with that," say, "Okay, I'm good with that. What, are we talking about a problem that needs to be resolved here?" "No, we're not." "Okay, then what are we talking about?"
Yeah.
So let's get to the things that are unresolved or unresolvable rather than the challenges that we actually do have in hand. That, and when a parent then says, when the kid says, "You know, my mother is constantly over my shoulder saying that my actions are her success or failure," what is that doing to you, the kid?
Yes.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Yes.
What are you going to do with that? "I'm going to move to the other side of the country. I'm going to intentionally fail so that my mother will be embarrassed and I could be no more delighted than seeing my mother struggle. And now, okay, is that the family you want to have? You want to build that legacy? Now we can get somewhere." When we start putting language to that kind of thing, we can get somewhere.
Hey, you know, you just utterly explained my attitude in high school that I used to tell teachers, if practice is perfect and nobody's perfect, why practice?
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's what I tell them. Like, okay, so I'm a C+B student without doing my homework. Apparently, I can make a C+ or B. What's the issue? Right. You know?
You're not going to get a good college. You won't get scholarships. You're not going to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force.
Yeah, yeah. You know, okay, if that's something that I am attempting to achieve or attain in my life, that is where I need to go. Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
And that's the thing. I was the kid who asked my geometry teacher why I needed to know the cubic area of a box. She's like, if you work in a box making factory, I'm like, yeah, I want to be a box maker when I grow up. That's what I want to do. Nowadays, I help pack 18 wheelers full of gear to go across the country. You realize how useful it is to know the interior square footage of your trailer?
Right, I understand it, but I explained it a different way.
Go ahead.
When you take a geometry course or advanced algebra, whatever, that deals with formulas, and it causes a section of your brain to develop.
It does.
That would not have developed in any other way, which is why art is so vital for the human brain.
Yes.
Foreign language is so vital for the human brain. Dance, gymnastics, movement, science, chemistry, things you can smell, things you can do, field trips you take. All of those things develop your brain in different ways.
Absolutely.
And when I was in school, from 5th grade to 10th grade, I took French. I hated every moment of French class. I despised it. I loathed it. It was made me miserable. I would break out in hives. I would cry over my homework. I hated it every other way. When I was allowed in 10th grade, I had my 2 years of language done. I was allowed to step out of French class. I took more art. I took blah, blah, blah. Fine. Okay. 14 years later, I was on a trip to Israel. And we landed at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris at 7:30 in the morning. We were not taking our flight to Tel Aviv until 5:30 at night. I am 20 miles from downtown Paris with 8 hours to kill.
Wow.
And I went up to the counter girl, the girl at the counter, and I said, she spoke English, and I said, can I get a taxi cab with my wife and go into Paris? And she said, they don't run on Saturdays. There's no business people coming. Sorry, you really can't do it. And I said, is there any way? Is there subway? Can I get any way to Paris? She goes, well, I could arrange an Air France bus for you. And I said, great. She goes, if you can come up with 30 people or so, that will give you $5. You can rent the bus for a day. I said, okay. She said, just to understand, if you don't get back here by 4:30 in the afternoon, you're going to miss your flight connection. You'll have to buy all new flights. No problem. We can do it. So I got 30 people, went around 7:30, now quarter after 8. We went up through check-in. They have our passports checked. We went into Paris. I walked up to the dispatcher. The dispatcher spoke not a single word of English, not one word.
Yeah.
She had not said what we wanted to do. So I had to talk to this guy in French to tell him I got 30 people who want to see Paris. We're taking a bus. He finally got us to the right bus. The bus driver spoke not one word of English, not a word.
Oh, my
God. So we
Lord.
Got
yeah.
on. And I said to him in my fledgling, tiddling baby French, what I wanted to do. So he kept calling over his shoulder. I was sitting back with the people watching the countryside of France. And he keeps leaning over his shoulder and talking to me. And I finally walked up the front. It's an Air France bus, so there's a microphone. So he tells me what he's pointing out. And I keep saying, I don't understand. In French, I don't understand. And he would talk more like he's talking to a baby. And then eventually he's pointing something at, I think, wait a minute, I remember that from French history class. Oh, I remember that from world history. And so I started telling the people on the bus what I was remembering. Then he would add a few words and he'd say something like the Red House is communist Russia. And so then I would tell the whole story about how the Russians came into France. And people thought I was actually hired by Air France to take them on a tour.
Yeah, right.
14 years later, I remembered enough French to take 30 people on a tour of Paris.
Yeah.
Negotiate. He says, go to the opera, buy pastries from a guy across the street, challenge all the money. I came back and my wife said, how did you do that? I know Greek. I know Hebrew. I know German. I know American Sign Language. I know English.
Wow.
How did you do that? And I said, well, I took French from 5th grade to 10th grade. She said, that came from 5th grade to 10th grade French. I said, it's in my brain somewhere.
Yeah.
I learned how to learn. The issue for algebra and geometry and French and art and history, and it teaches my brain how to learn something.
Yes.
So you may not have been able to figure out the interior dimensions of a box, but you learned how to learn something.
That's right.
And that applied to everything else
exactly.
you ever do in life.
Exactly. And to this day, and what was funny was the next year, I was my senior year. I didn't have to take a math, but I was taking shop. And one of the first things that we had to do was figure out the square board footage of what we were going to build. And I was like, well, I'll be darned. Look at that Pythagorean theorem. I was like, look at that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Hot diggity.
It's the same thing with calculus, and calculus just made sense to me. Isaac Newton was being punished as a 14-year-old because he was disobedient to his father. He got sent to his room for 2 weeks when he was 14 years old. While he was in his room, he invented calculus because he could think of problems that couldn't be solved by normal math. What kid is grounded and goes to their room without their iPhone and comes up with calculus? There's a reality of being able to make your mind learn how to learn.
Yes. Yes.
That is a lifelong skill that will never fade away.
Well,
ever.
It
will never fade away.
And the thing is, like, I have a very, very good friend who, when my child was born, called me, congratulated me, and was like, man, you're just looking forward to the next 20 years of experiments, aren't you? And I was like, yeah. He knew me so well, because it's literally the fact of, I sit back and let a kid go, and whenever I see what they want to do, because my kid obviously wants to play with all these things in the background. So he has versions of these things that he can play with. That is something that I will instill in him. And like, he's got a Hammond out front. Well, I have a Hammond out front, but he plays it and pulls the stops and knows what the drawbars do. And he's 3.5 years old out there making his own music, doing his own thing. And it's one of those, if you learn to see that in children and learn to instill those things early, it really is amazing where they can go, because you're absolutely enabling them to find their own way.
One of the podcasts that Mike and I did was The Purpose of Parenting, because it really is a critical issue.
It is.
And many parents that, obviously, children are born without a handbook for parents. Every once in a while, I'll run into some Christian people and say, well, the Bible is the handbook. You say, okay, when your kid spills their milk for the fourth time tonight at dinner, where in the Bible does it tell you what to do about that?
Makes a decent paddle. Sorry. I had to, come on. It was just lobbed over the plate.
No, that's true. But the question is, what do you see the purpose of being a parent is?
Yeah.
And many parents will say, well, I want my kids to be obedient. I don't want my kid to embarrass me. I want my kid to become something. Well, we define parenting as raising successful adults.
That's right.
While you have the privilege of having them in your home as children and adolescents. The key then is, when they're disobedient, are they actually showing real leadership? They're violating policy. They're setting their own agenda. That's what leaders do.
Darn
tootin'. You can either say, you are threatening my control, or you are an emerging leader. Which one is it? Same behavior is done both ways. When they choose to come in after curfew or they leave their room a total mess, you say, there's are certain skills that I want you to have by the time
you're
an independent adult.
Hey.
You're going to be, let's just say, barring a tragedy, you're going to live 80 years. 20 of them will be in my home. 60 of them are going to be
in your
own adult agenda.
That's right.
I want your 60 years to be more successful because of the first 20. So I am raising a successful adult through their childhood and adolescence. That changes every dynamic that goes on in the family.
Absolutely.
It's not for me to have an obedient child. It's for me to have a successful adult by the end of the process.
That's right.
And if you have that in mind, that alters the course on when do you yell at your child, when do you instruct them, when do you require them to have the same values you hold. Some values are important.
Sure.
Not eating sugar for all 3 meals a day is an extremely important adult skill.
Absolutely.
So you do not want a child to be eating cookies, candied cereal, and sweets 3 meals a day. Because as an adult, that will be destructive. So leaving their clothes a mess on the floor. Are there adults? Nobody listening, of course, to you, because you're a neat freak. I can see everything's really straight.
No, you see
there.
All this dark area?
Yeah, let's keep with my illustration.
How nebulous it is.
Everyone who's listening keeps their own room nice and neat, and as soon as laundry is done, it's folded and put away. But hey, other people out there may have messy rooms.
That's right.
The reality is they don't care.
Yeah.
If they need a blouse or a skirt or a pair of pants or something to be clean, by golly, they're going to get it clean tonight, or they're going to wear it dirty, or they're going to get Febreze that takes away body odor. They're going to do something to figure out how to have the appearance of clean, and that's okay.
Yes.
That's on right. My agenda. So when my kids left their room messy, and then they said, oh, I need my band shirt. How about that? Figure it out.
How'd that work out for you?
I mean, it's a critical question. They say, well, I'm going to go down and do laundry. Here's my laundry, Mom. Do laundry. No.
Nope.
Here's the washing machine. Do laundry.
Yeah, you
so
remember.
From the age of 4 or 5, literally 4 or 5, our kids were doing their own laundry.
Right
then
here.
They learned how to do each other's laundry and yep. share, because that's an important adult skill.
Yeah. My brother was 3 years older than me. I was 5. He was 8. We were folding our own laundry.
Sure, absolutely.
We were washing it. We were doing all that stuff. Absolutely. We wanted a cat. We scooped the cat litter.
Sure.
Like, and that's just it. Even now, my son is 3 years old. Every day, you know what? Hey, big guys go out and check the mail, man. That's where bills come, son. Let's hop out and see if anybody sent us anything today. Sure. And I'm so sad that the raccoons got a hold of my chickens, because that was part of the chickens. Was that when he was about this age, it would be his job to go out and feed the chickens to make sure right. that they're watered every day. You know, things that he is able to do at 3 and a half going on 4 years old.
It's all the shreds to be able to say, I want to protect my child from that kind of thing. Say, wait a minute. As an adult, now they may you yeah. assess your child's abilities, their capacities. And there are certain capacities, certain events that are beyond the capacity
yes.
of a child at that time. You Absolutely. Understand that. You're not going to give them the keys to the car when they're 4 years old.
No.
But you might be able to help them, have them ride the lawnmower with you.
That's right.
And help here so they learn how to begin to operate yeah. equipment with a motor and have respect for what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And they can't just lose their attention when they're dealing with a powerful machine. That's an adult skill you
That's
want
right.
them to have. Find the opportunities that you have within your environment to be able to equip them and expand their capacities in equipping them with adult skills.
Prime example, right behind me on the wall, you see a great collection of guitars. I've built them all from scratch.
Wow.
And there's one guitar that hangs out in the living room, and that's my acoustic that I learned to play on and things like that. And my son loves my acoustic. For a long time, he loved the ukulele that my dad brought me from Hawaii.
Sure.
And it got to a point where he was pretty respectful with it. And I was like, you know what? Dad's going to get you something special, son. So I ordered him a guitar, and he has his own classical guitar. It hangs out on the wall opposite Dad's.
Nice.
And it's got its own hanger and everything. And he knows he can't put the guitar on the ground. He can have it on the couch. He walks around, he plays with it, everything else. And when he's done, he goes and puts it back on the rack.
Puts it back on the wall.
Puts it back on the wall, because that's where it's safe. That's where it's supposed to go.
And ultimately, if he leaves the guitar out and it gets broken,
hey, whatever.
He may say, that didn't matter to me, or he may say, that did matter to me.
Sure.
And I'm going to treat my possessions differently
that's
as a
right.
result. And when he's 45 years old himself, he'll be able to say, I treat my possessions in a certain way because
that's right.
my parents invested in me the responsibility and privilege
that's right.
of owning real things. And
yep.
that becomes a necessary adult skill. So for us, the purpose of parenting was to raise successful adults through their childhood and youth. And we teach those skills as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just it. I mean, I say it on this show frequently. For a little while, I had a version that I've considered rebooting called Dads and Beer, where it was literally just a conversation on modern fatherhood, you know,
sure.
and the fact that, like, yeah, no, we need to teach boys that it is okay to feel. Yeah. Feeling is okay. What you need to do is get to the root of that feeling. What you need to do is get to the root of how you're enacting that feeling out in the world, you know?
Yeah.
But it's okay to feel. There was an entire generation of us brought up with this concept of the big tough guy and the fact that that wussies cried, you know? Hey man, I'm here to tell you folks, I'm going to look right at the camera. I am a 45-year-old man. I own 3 or 4 businesses, and you know what? I cry. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. Like, there are just times, like, man, when all this happened, like, I lost an entire income, Doc. Not even playing.
Yeah.
When it came through that lockdowns were happening and cancellations started, I tell people now, anytime I went to apply for help, it was like the scene from The Crying Game.
Sure.
I just went and huddled in the shower. It was like, oh God, I don't have to remember this again, do I? Because it was like, man, I was having a banner year. It was one of the best years ever. Like for my business, for my career, everything. And yeah, like it took a lot to get a hold of that. I know people that are quite literally having emotional issue and anxiety because of the fact that they are 45 years old and never not worked.
Sure.
You know, and they don't know what it's like. They can't fathom a life without work. And they've done this thing for so long. They've been an audio engineer, video engineer for 30 or something years. You know, that's a very focused skill set. And they've just never not worked, you know? And it's heartbreaking to see that with some people, because they are literally in their 40s having to find themselves again, having to redefine themselves and having to realize that, like,
this is a skill I have,
but is this who I am?
Right. In 10 years, they may say, you know, the year 2020 was the worst hell and the best heaven at the same time, because I learned that I was not just twisting buttons and doing my job. I was more than that. But I had to come to the end of my rope before I discovered I was more than the occupation.
Yeah.
The problem is you can say to somebody without the COVID year of 2020, you know, you're not just your job. You're not just a career. You're not just a cog in the wheel. You actually have more to offer than that. And the problem is that falls on deaf ears until the crisis occurs.
Yep.
When the crisis occurs, it can be destructive, but can also be very constructive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was going to say, and this may sound horrible as I finish a drink, but so much of this is echoed in the principles of programs like AA. And really, it brings me back a lot and reminds me, number one, of the seminary, and number two, of why some people are bitter when they leave the seminary. Because it really is a
bitter or better?
Better or bitter, bitter when they leave. Not better. I mean, they're better too, eventually, you know, but it's the fact that there is a purposeful deconstruction. It's almost like a spiritual boot camp that you're put through to deconstruct you.
It's not almost like spiritual boot camp.
It is a spiritual boot camp. Exactly. And it took me years to realize the wisdom of what went on and why things were, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, so much of it is echoed in the teachings of programs like AA, NA, things like that, where, you're the only catalyst. There's no wife that can keep you from your addiction. that, like, it is you and whatever your greater power is. I don't care if it's the dog outside or the tree or God or Jesus or Buddha or what have you. It is you, your greater power, and your willpower that keep you from anything like that.
One of the things that have been an amazing privilege for me as a pastor of a local church is to walk alongside families when a family member is dying.
Yes.
The challenge that occurs there, many pastors really are overwhelmed personally by that set of experiences. My transformation came when I was 15 years old. I watched my mother die. Mm-hmm. My father was an alcoholic. He was at a bar drinking. He remarried within a couple of months, and I have five step-siblings and five kids in my family, and we all love each other now. We got through a lot of very difficult times. But sitting in that room, I was a secular Jewish kid, and I'm not religious at all. And my mother was Jewish, and I had a sense that somebody got up and walked out of the room as surely as if a human body had gotten up. It was just me and my mother in a machine. And I went out and found a nurse, and I said, something just happened in my mother's room. She came running in, and she said, no, everything's the same. Heart-lung machine was keeping her going, and all the machinery was there, and she had cancer. And I said, no, something happened. It was like somebody got up and walked out of the room. The nurse looked me square in the face and said, your mother probably just died. I said, what are you talking about?
Wow.
And she said, that was your mother's spirit probably leaving her body. I said, I don't get that. And because I had no expectation of that happening. We weren't a spiritual family.
Yeah.
And she said, well, some people can sense that kind of thing and other people can't. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I've been a nurse a long time and I just seen it over and over. So that put me on a journey where my father committed suicide a few years later. And so we've dealt with a lot of really difficult situations. What I found is, to put it in a metaphorical kind of image, when you start out in life, you're on a pathway, you're on a journey. That's a common metaphor. And as you enter the world, most people have a father, mother, maybe some siblings, grandparents, nieces, nephews, aunts and uncles. You have this kind of group of people around you. Some people have very few, and maybe even none, but most people have this little group that's walking along the journey with them.
Yeah.
As you go through life, and you have more friends in second grade and sixth grade, and then you become more popular in high school, or you're on a football team, you have more people on your pathway walking alongside you. You get into business, and maybe your crowd is 1,000 people or 10,000 people or 100,000 people, and they're all walking along with you in different paces and different times. But as you get to the last part of your journey, those thousands and tens of thousands walk away from your path. They're on their own path or they're gone. Yeah. And then it's down to family members. And then it's maybe down to spouse and children. Then maybe it's down to one child. But eventually, the last part of the path, you walk it alone.
It's just you.
You walk from this life to whatever is coming next. You walk that part of the path alone. And the challenge for many people is they are terrified of that moment. That aloneness, they cannot imagine what that actually means, what's really happening in that moment. As a pastor, that's when, and I have to let go of the hand of the person. I mean, I might hold their physical body hand, but I have to let go of the hand of their soul as they pass on. I've seen it maybe 60 or 70 times, and it is an amazing privilege to be the last person or one of the very last that is walking that part of the path as someone disappears from this life. That is incredibly important
Absolutely.
For people to understand. But when you go through that boot camp, that kind of spiritual remaking, sometimes on your journey, you're down to just you on the path.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where amazing miracles happen. That to me is where the miraculous transformation can take place.
Amen. Amen. It really can. And that's not to get religious with anybody with that. Amen.
I'm not talking about religion at all.
Well, and that's just it. My audience knows I am a spiritual man, and it is the fact that I don't care which capital R religion you're a part of, or whether you follow a little s spirituality. I challenge you to find one that doesn't teach this precept that isn't sure. Giving you this base knowledge to work with, you know, and it really is something that when you get down to it, it is that harsh reality of hitting your own personal bottom. And yeah, some people rise to that challenge. Some people, that challenge overcomes them, you know, and that's where you
let's take a moment though, Chris.
Sure.
There may be people listening to this radio show, this podcast, who really are at the last few moments of their life by their own choice.
Yeah.
My response to that is, do not make a permanent decision for what is a temporary problem.
That's right.
I know you are walking that path absolutely alone, but that is not true.
You're not. Yes.
And you will get the steps down the road that will allow you to remake yourself or remake your situation. And this time of singularity has been a gift, not a penalty. You will be allowed to reform who you are on what matters the most to you. So instead of ending the journey right now, find a way to take one more step. And if you take that step, you'll still be on the path. You'll get there. You will get there.
That's right. Yeah.
That's extremely important for people to understand.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, I've been at that point. I have been at that point personally. Your host, folks, like I've been at that breaking point spiritually, psychologically. I have been at that point of utter self-doubt and negative self-reflection. And I'm here. I'm here. Because I guess I'm a hopeful romantic, Doc, in that proper way where if anything, I have the chance to say thank you when I go to bed and thank you when I wake up in the morning. Sure. You know, and I've really chosen to see that fact of every day is the opportunity that I make it. Like I make it, like I said earlier, just to bring this back full circle to the beginning of the conversation where I was my own self-fulfilling prophecy. And, you know, now it's the fact of, I wake up with the decision to do something. There's no longer a decision to let despair take over, things like that. It's just the fact of failure is not an option. You
and
know.
Part of it is when we wake up in a context. It would be wonderful if I was in absolute control of every factor in my life. I'm not. But the question then is the factors that I am in control of and the factors I am not in control of, what are they doing to me and what do I do with them? If I can put some creative thinking time into those two questions, I can then face the day. I can meet the challenges.
I can fall
victim to the challenges, and that's okay too, because I'm within the context of my circumstances. But tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up. It's going to be a different day. I'm going to have a different set of capacities and values, and we're going to go at it again.
I'm good with that.
It's okay.
Yeah.
If I succeed or I fail or somewhere in between, I'm good with that.
And that's just it. It finally came to a realization in my life that, you know what? At least if I am failing, I am failing on my terms.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Like, at least I am owning that. Yeah, I failed. Right. So what? Did you get up and swing? I did. You know, sure, like right. If I fail, okay.
Sometimes you fail and it's not on your terms, but sure. I'm okay with that too. The reality is that the marginal success or the utter failure or the whatever, wherever we are on the scale between 0 and 100, the reality is that's me.
That's
I'm okay with me. I don't feel like I need to beat me up. If the world is doing a pretty good job of beating me up as well,
yeah,
I still have me, and I'm walking. For me, it's my faith in God, and that to me is rock solid. I'm not compromising that in any way. But the reality is, not everybody has that in the degree or type that I have.
Yes,
but that's not my question. My question is, what is it doing to you, and what do you do with it? Now, if we can talk about those two questions, we can actually get somewhere in the tangled mess that's causing such distress. We can do it. We can do that.
Oh, man. Doc, I could go on for hours and hours and hours with you, man. this is quite literally been like my last 20 years of realization in life almost. It's been so great to talk with you about this and to talk with Mike Wilson as well, your co-host with Gripping Reality. Where can people go to find out more about this method that you're talking about? Where can they go to find, other than the Dudes and Beer Store, where can they go to find your book? Not just this book, your books. Like, you need a whole page in the Dudes and Beer Store by yourself. You got so many books. But where can they go to get
most of what I've published has been manuals and training resources that I published myself and reproduce, make copies of. I have a number of different books and stuff for children, for pastors. I do a lot of training.
Icebreakers, things like that.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. I wrote a book on Gospel of Luke. I've written one on Jonah. I'm working on one on the Book of Revelation with a new philosophy or new interpretation that's never been heard from before.
Brother, we got to do a Jonah episode.
We won't get into that right now, but that might be a really good show.
Jonah is one of the examples I give people all the time of, like, you just don't understand. You have a purpose, and that will be shown to you numerous times, whether you choose to believe it or not.
My book on Jonah is called Angry at God.
Yes.
The real meaning of the book of Jonah.
Yes.
And what happens is God says to Jonah, go offer, you're a Jew, go to Nazi Germany and offer salvation to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, I can't do it.
Hell no.
And then if you do it, you're not doing your job. If you let him off the hook, you're not doing your job. Anyway, that's the book of Jonah. This book, Why Do People Act That Way, is on Amazon. We have a print-on-demand version. We have an ebook, and we have an Audible book.
Yes.
That you can get it the three ways. You can write to either me or Mike. Spell Mike with a Y or an I. It doesn't matter. Mike@grippingreality.com. And we will get your email. We'll be able to answer questions. We can come for training. We can do virtual. We can do one-on-one consultation. We've spoken to groups of 4,000 down to groups of 5 and 6. So we can do business. Yeah. We can do church. We can do family. We really can do anything, because what we talk about is how human beings experience reality and what do they do with it. And that's what we have, not only knowledge and philosophy and concepts, but we have skills and we have techniques and we have practice sessions, so that people can come out saying, aha, I understand it, and aha, I can do it. Those two must be coupled together. I use the word must judiciously. They must be coupled for something to be successful in my own life. I must understand it, and I must have the skill to do it.
Those two
wed together, and it actually makes a life.
Yeah. And man, so much great information in this episode. So many different places to take this conversation, and I cannot wait to have you on another time. Like, this is me is just a primer episode, folks. This is one of those guests that I guarantee you, like I said earlier, these are the principles that we talk about on this show all the time. you know, and how to you can't really help fill somebody's glass until you know how to fill a glass. And you have to be willing to accept the fact that you have an empty glass, people, and that you need to learn how to fill it.
Sometimes people ask me, you know, are you a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of guy?
I'm just to acknowledge the fact you got a freaking glass.
No. Why is the glass twice as big as it needs to be?
Right? Who gave me this huge glass? And that's a great way to put it, because it really is, like you were saying earlier, just to bring it back full circle, that filter of reality through experience, and the fact that our reality is our experience, and that reality is individual to every single person. And that's what we need to get back to, is understanding that reality is individual to every single person. Head on out, folks. Please do hold the line while we close things out, Doctor. While you're online checking out everything over at Why Do People Act That Way.com, where you can book Mike and Mike for speaking, for all kinds of stuff, where you can find all the downloadable books, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast, everybody. That is, of course, where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can find the knowledge vault with declassified government documents, scientific documents, UFO and paranormal stuff. We've also got the videos page with videos from all of our guests, stuff like that. So make sure to stop on by there. Make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer store as well. And while you're doing that, make sure to stop on by HC Universal Network. That is our home network. Tons of great content there. Talking Sound Podcast, Yes But Why Podcast, Scary Dad Podcast, Therapy Hour with Rusty Lozano, all kinds of great stuff. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.